Is it ever right to break the law? Let's make the question more specific, since I'm not asking about robbing banks or knocking off jewelry stores. Is it ever right to break the law on grounds that the law is unjust? Well, whether right or not, civil disobedience of one sort or another has been a widespread feature of the last two generations. In 1963, activists led by Martin Luther King peacefully but systematically violated various ordinances in Birmingham, Alabama, and other cities, which called for racial segregation in public places. In 2010, at the G20 diplomatic conference in Toronto, Canada, some activists organized peaceful rallies, others rioted and practiced various other forms of violence, mostly against capitalism as an economic system. In 2011, members of the Occupy Wall Street movement, I'm sure you know about that, living here in New York, took over a public park for some weeks to protest economic inequality. In 2015, following the injury and death of a young man who had been arrested, numerous protesters, some peaceful, some violent, took to the streets in Baltimore, Maryland, alleging that blacks and whites were treated radically differently by police. But civil disobedience of one sort or another is not just a feature of our time. It's taken place for centuries. Consider ancient history. In about 1539 BC, Hebrew midwives disobeyed a direct command of the Hebrew king, the Pharaoh, to kill all male Hebrew infants upon birth. In 539 BC, Daniel, a young Hebrew who was a captive, and but he had been trained, educated. He was appointed as a satrap, which was a kind of governor, under the Persian king Darius. He disobeyed a royal edict, which had the effect of prohibiting him from praying to God. He prayed anyway, and he prayed publicly. During the late 5th century BC, the philosopher Socrates, it's a little unclear here, it's not so clear what the laws were, but he appears to have disregarded laws, or at least customs that had legal force, against discrediting the pagan laws of Athens. At his trial, he was accused of inventing new gods and corrupting the youth. In about 30 AD, the apostles in Jerusalem disobeyed a command of the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem not to teach about Jesus Christ. Or consider just the history of our own country, not just the last generation or so, but from the beginning. In 1773, a Massachusetts group calling itself the Sons of Liberty, I'm sure you know, protested the Stamp Act, which imposed a tax on tea without allowing Americans representation in Parliament. The protesters destroyed an entire shipment of tea by throwing it into Boston Harbor. In 1859, yet another kind of civil disobedience of a sort, the abolitionist John Brown attempted to instigate an armed slave revolt by raiding and taking over a government arsenal at Harper's Ferry, Virginia. During the 1960s, this is burned into my memory, perhaps 34,000 young men refused to comply with the selective service laws by burning their draft cards or returning them, which was a kind of demonstration in itself, more conspicuous in some ways than burning it, because the draft board knew what you had done, and some soldiers deserted or refused to fight. The pro-life movement, although most pro-life demonstrators do not violate any laws, during the 1990s, members of a group called Operation Rescue systematically staged a series of peaceful blockages of the entrance to abortion clinics in the attempt to force them to shut down for the day. Well, these cases are all very different. Obviously, the term civil disobedience covers a lot of territory. Some of the acts of disobedience I've mentioned were intended as protests. Others were not. They just disobeyed. Of those which could be described as protests, some of them violated the same law that they were protesting. Others protested one law, say, protested a tax law, by violating a different law, say, a law protecting property from destruction. Some protested one law. Others protested an institution upheld by law, such as slavery. Others, an entire social and economic system that had legal underpinnings, such as capitalism. Some of these instances of civil disobedience have been organized. Others have been private. Some have been peaceful. Others have been violent. Well, I ask again, is it ever right? Is it ever right to break the law on grounds that the law is unjust? I'm not trying to cover every single theory of this that has ever been considered, but I am going to talk about at some length about one such theory. Now, I'm going to introduce it, though, through something that is perhaps more well-known. Many of you have perhaps read or know of Martin Luther King's famous letter from Birmingham jail, in which he defended his acts of civil disobedience, those of his organization and his followers, in protest of segregation laws. And he defended a mode of civil disobedience that he called direct action. Now, in the letter from Birmingham jail, King mentions a number of sources of his convictions on this subject. It's a rhetorical treatise. He was trying to justify himself to the authorities and to people who were sitting on the fence and wondering whether this was right. He wasn't writing as a philosopher, but he was writing logically and clearly and persuasively. And he mentions his sources. Some of them were his historical sources, biblical sources, philosophical sources, examples of civil disobedience in the Bible, in secular history. But I'm going to go back pretty far here. Among the philosophical sources that King himself mentioned was the work of the 13th century Dominican friar St. Thomas Aquinas. Aquinas, widely regarded, I suppose you know that here, you often come to talks, I guess, put on by the Thomistic Institute, is widely regarded as one of the two or three greatest thinkers in history. I certainly think so. He presented the first, to my knowledge, and the most influential analysis of civil disobedience in the history of Western thought. Even theories of civil disobedience that disagree with his have to respond to it, directly or indirectly, whether acknowledging it or not acknowledging it. He's always in the background. His approach is always in the background. Now, since he was a member of a religious order, obviously, you might think that his analysis would be based entirely on the Bible. That would be a very popular stereotype. Actually, although he does refer to the Bible and believes that the Bible is true and authoritative and tries to be faithful to it, he does so. If you actually read his discussion of this, most of his references to the Bible are not where he's developing his theory, but where he's dealing with objections to his view. Some people might say, because of this in the Bible, that I'm wrong, and here's why I don't think so. Some people think that the Bible condemns civil disobedience. Aquinas believes that this view is quite mistaken and tries to show this to be the case. His theory of civil disobedience is grounded mostly, then, on the natural law. The natural law, in other words, on moral principles that are known or at least knowable to any rational mind. And I think his theory is, by and large, right. I don't necessarily defend it in every detail, but it's influenced my own thinking profoundly. I think it's quite brilliant. So that's what I really want to talk about. Aquinas holds that true laws, there is a distinction here. To say true laws implies that there are phony laws, and that's exactly right. Aquinas holds that true laws, that is to say just laws, in accord with the natural law, really do generate a conscientious duty to obey just because they are laws. An authentic law is something that is capable of serving as a rule and as a measure of human action. And in order to serve that role, he says that an enactment has to be an ordinance of reason for the common good, made by public authority and promulgated or made known. In other words, it must be something that the thoughtful mind can recognize as right. That's what it means to say that it's an ordinance of reason. It must be something that serves the whole community rather than just private interest. That's what it means to say that it's directed to the common good. It must be something made by those who are responsible for the whole community, competent public authority, and it must be something made known to the public for whom it is a law. If an enactment violates even one of those four conditions, Thomas Aquinas says then it is unjust. But he also says, the expression unjust law is really a sort of a figure of speech. It's not literal, because a so-called unjust law, and even though I will continue to use the phrase, is not really a law at all. It's a mock law. It's a fake law. It is an enactment that is masquerading as law, but is not, in fact, something that is capable of serving as a rule and measure of human action. Aquinas, quoting Augustine, says that such a thing is better regarded as an act of violence. Now, you might think that since a so-called unjust law is not really a law, but an act of violence, that therefore any unjust law may be violated. Not so fast. One of the hallmarks of Aquinas' thought about this is that we have to make sure that we do not act unethically even when we are avoiding something unethical or resisting something unethical. The mere fact that a law is wrong does not make anything whatsoever that we do against it right. One of the things that we have to consider is, well, how wrong the law is. Aquinas doesn't suggest just a sort of a yardstick. Well, a little bit wrong, a lot wrong, still more wrong, very, very wrong. No, he makes a twofold distinction. There are two different ways in which a human enactment can be unjust. And one of them is infinitely worse than the other. Of course, all unjust laws are bad. All unjust laws undermine the good or the well-being of human beings. But some of them only undermine our common good, our shared good in this world, the temporal aspects of our good, while others undermine the integrity of our relationship with God, which is a matter of eternal importance, because they require us to perform intrinsically evil deeds. Obedience to the former kind of unjust law would, you know, that kind of unjust law hurts us only in this life. But obedience to the latter kind of unjust law would hurt us eternally. It damages us in our very souls to comply with it. It makes us unjust too. So let's begin with the less serious case, and then I'll talk about the more serious case. Let's begin with the less serious case, the case in which an enactment is contrary only to our temporal common good, not to our eternal and divine good. Now, that might seem a little bit abstract, but Thomas Aquinas spins it out. He spells it out. This could happen in three different ways. He says the law might be unjust in this worldly sense because there is a defect in the enactment's end, that is to say, a defect in its purpose. That means that the enactment doesn't even aim at the common good. For instance, lawmakers might enact a particular regulation just in order to give unjust advantages to their cronies. And we see an awful lot of that sort of thing. Or, number two, there is a defect in the enactment's author. What does that mean? It means the enactment is not made with the proper authority. Some contemporary examples might be that the courts might usurp the role of the legislature, or the executive might defy the Constitution, or legislators might usurp the rightful duties of parents, you know, and barge into things that are not proper matters of legislation at all. Number three, there might be a defect in the enactment's form. What does that mean? That means that the enactment violates the very definition of justice, the pattern or form of justice, which is that every person should be given what is due to him, what we owe to him, what his right is, what it is right to give him, what he deserves. For instance, the government might impose disproportionate burdens on various groups of people with no good reason. Sometimes there are good reasons for treating different groups of people differently. For instance, we say that if you're beyond a certain age, you can apply for a driver's license, but if you're a small child, you can't. We're treating two different groups differently, but that's not unjust. There is a reason for this. but we're talking about arbitrary differences here. Or the government might award civil service positions or entrance to public universities to the least qualified rather than the best qualified people or to cronies. You know, this would be a defect in the enactment's form. So in these three ways, you know, a defect in the enactment's purpose, in its author, or in its form, this is a law which is wrong, it's unjust, it hurts us, it injures our common good, our shared good in this life. Suppose an enactment has at least one of those three kinds of defect, end, author, or form, but nothing else is wrong with it. I don't mean to deprecate it's wrong. I mean, that's very wrong. But suppose nothing else is wrong with it. In other words, it's contrary to the temporal common good. Maybe the government is taxing me unjustly, and other people are being let off free or something. But it does not demand of me any intrinsically evil deeds. It doesn't require me to do something that is going to directly hinder my relationship with the very author of all good and all justice. Well, remember, an unjust law is not a true law. It doesn't have the properties that make it suitable for directing the conduct of rational beings. Now, it would be absurd to say that we have to obey a phony law just because it is a law, because it isn't a law. But, he says, in some cases, an enactment which is unjust just in this first way may be obeyed not because it's a true law, but simply in order to avoid harm to others. How could that be? Let me give a silly example just to illustrate. Suppose the people in my town had voted against the people on the current city council, and the city council gets into office and wants to retaliate against the people in my neighborhood. In my precinct, and so they send out the police to change all the traffic signs, and just to punish us, nobody can drive more than 2 miles an hour. Now, this would be an unjust punishment, right? On the other hand, you can see that if everybody, in fear of the police, in fear of being ticketed, is obeying the 2-mile-an-hour thing, it might be a very foolish, reckless, and dangerous thing to your neighbors to go at a higher speed. Even though they shouldn't be restricting you to 2 miles an hour, if you zip along at 30, you might be hitting some kids. You might be striking other vehicles. So you can see that even though an enactment like that is unjust, there may be reasons having to do with public order why it might be better to suffer the harm and go along with it if it isn't requiring anything intrinsically evil of you. He's more systematic. Thomas Aquinas is a little bit more systematic. He says, basically, there are two ways that this can happen, because there are two ways in which the failure to obey an unjust law might harm others. One is that if I disobey it, I might cause disorder or confusion. That could be confusion because people are puzzled about what the law is. It could be confusion in the sense that I unintentionally trigger a riot in which many people are hurt or in which homes or businesses are burned down. The other way is that I might cause scandal. This doesn't mean being written up in People magazine. It means that I might unintentionally mislead persons of weak understanding who don't really understand what I'm doing. They say, well, he's disobeying the law. I guess it's okay to disobey the law. And they even start disobeying just laws. So I've caused scandal in the sense of causing somebody else to slip morally. Okay? That's the old-fashioned meaning of scandal. In cases where you might cause turmoil or confusion or scandal, Thomas Aquinas says, well, you have to weigh things. Which way is there more harm, if I obey this law or if I don't obey this law? I don't have to obey it because it's a law, because it isn't a law. The conscientious duty that I owe to law, because it is law, is absent here. But just out of concern for my neighbors, I may still have to weigh this matter. Okay, that's the less serious case. Let's talk about the more serious case. This is the case in which the law is unjust because it requires us to do things that are intrinsically evil, which, as natural law thinkers sometimes put it, which cannot be ordered to our ultimate good. For example, The law might require citizens to help soldiers load Jews onto boxcars to be taken to death camps. Or it might require medical workers to assist in abortion or euthanasia. Or it might require the children to give their parents poison when the parents reach 70 years of age. Or it might require stealing or dishonoring parents or profaning the institution of marriage or dishonoring God or worshiping a false god such as the emperor or the government itself. Nothing in the world can justify doing what is intrinsically evil. That's the whole point of calling it intrinsically evil. It is to say that there are some evils of that kind. They're not just evil because of bad results. They're evil in themselves. Such an act is by its very nature incapable of being directed to our ultimate final good, and in all such cases, nothing whatsoever could justify obedience. You must disobey. You must disobey, even at the cost of your life, if that's what it takes. The upshot, then, is that in the case of the first kind of unjust laws, laws contrary to our good just in this world, one might disobey, depending on whether the risk of harm is greater in obeying or in disobeying the unjust law. But in the case of the second kind of unjust law, laws contrary to our eternal good because they command intrinsically evil acts, one must disobey. This time there is no depending. This time there is no weighing. Take a minute to consider the instances of civil disobedience that I listed earlier. I'm not going to recapitulate every one of them. What were there? About 22 of them, something like that. Ancient ones, recent ones, early American ones. But we can review them mentally and ask whether by Aquinas' criteria which ones might have been proper, which ones not. For example, I think you can see that Aquinas would have insisted that the Hebrew midwives disobey the royal command to slay all male Hebrew infants. They had to disobey, and they did. He may or may not have considered it right to disobey the Stamp Act and not pay the tax, depending on how much harm the act did to the common good and how much harm by scandal or disturbance you might cause to your neighbors by not paying it. But he would not have allowed the destruction of the property of English merchants in order to protest it, because they were not the ones at fault. There's a difference between disobedience and committing some other crime. In all cases, he would have forbidden violence and rioting. Aquinas' analysis, it's admirable for his precision. I find sometimes when I teach these sorts of things that people will occasionally protest precision. They think, oh, you know, you can't put this down. Life is not arithmetic. Life is not all logic. There are many things that are very difficult to analyze. There are things other than logic, but you can't ever go against what is reasonable. And people will complain about hair splitting. Well, you know, it depends on what hairs you're splitting. If it's a silly hair, it doesn't need to be split. You don't do it. Don't split hairs just to split hairs. But if there's a distinction that is helpful, if it really calls attention to a difference between two really different kinds of things, then you should make it. And I think the precision of his analysis is admirable. Now, it might give us a false idea, though. Even if we agree that it's admirable, we might get the idea, okay, there are no further questions to be asked, nothing further to be explored, he's nailed it all down, I've got it, far from it. Consider, for example, that business about scandal, right? Unintentionally causing a bad moral example to somebody else. You know, you want to not only avoid evil, but you have to avoid the appearance of evil so that you don't lead others unintentionally into evil. That's scandal. Okay, Aquinas had argued that when we're dealing with an unjust law of the first kind, we should obey in those cases where disobeying might pose a grave risk of bad example to others. Martin Luther King offers a brilliant and fascinating twist on that. He accepts Aquinas' principle about the avoidance of bad moral example, but he applies this point in a dynamic rather than an aesthetic way. In other words, rather than saying if there's a very grave risk of bad example to others, don't do it. He says, see if you can find a way to disobey that would not pose that risk of bad moral example. That's why, he said, otherwise it would seem arbitrary and unreasonable. That's why, he said, that protesters may disobey the unjust law only after attempts to change the law through discussion with the authorities have been exhausted. That's why, he says, that when they disobey, they must do so for the sake of justice rather than revenge. That's why, he says, that when they disobey, they must do so publicly rather than secretly, and why they must give a public explanation of their reasons for disobedience and must publicly accept the penalty of the law, even though it is an unjust law, for disobedience. That's why he says that they should offer no resistance whatsoever, even if spat upon, beaten with nightsticks, sprayed with high-pressure fire hoses, bitten by police dogs, and carried off to prison, which in fact was what was going on then. Now, this raises an empirical question. King thought, if you did all these things, then you would avoid scandal. Everybody would understand what you were doing. And so, because everybody would understand what you were doing, he believed that it would cause a good example rather than a bad example and arouse people's consciences so that the unjust law was changed, so that even the opponents would be converted. The strategy was spectacularly successful in bringing about an end to U.S. laws requiring racial segregation. And more than that, in changing people's thinking about the matter and about the equality of the races. On the other hand, his strategy, although it has been followed by some others, it has been much less successful in overcoming some other injustices, such as the official protection of abortion. And it's worthwhile, I think, to consider why. Why has it been? He would have expected it to be, I think, to be just as successful in one case as the other, just as successful in avoiding scandal in one case as the other, just as successful in arousing conscience in one case as the other. The argument is often made that this is the reason. Sometimes people say, the unjust legal status quo concerning abortion is literally impossible to disobey because it doesn't command people to participate in abortion but only permits them to. How do you disobey a permission? Okay, I might say, I won't do that, but you're not disobeying the law. That argument is weak. That's not a very good argument, I think, because the law, although the law does not command people to participate in abortion and only permits them to, ultimately, a culture of killing the weak cannot be sustained by permissive laws alone. It's going to require that certain monies change hands. It's going to require that certain provisions be included in insurance plans. It's going to require that certain officials do what they are told. It's going to require that certain voices be silenced. And it's going to require that certain information be suppressed. For just a small example, in the 1994 case, Madsen versus Women's Health Center Incorporated, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a provision of Florida law which established a 36-foot zone around an abortion clinic. Within this zone, peaceful demonstrations were permitted if they were pro-abortion, but not if they were pro-life. Now, you could disobey that, right? You can't disobey a permission to commit an abortion, but you can disobey an oppressive passing law that is manifestly unjust because it only allowed protesters of one view to protest. Could you have staged civil disobedience to that? Well, a possible mode of civil disobedience, and this kind of thing has been tried, might be for pro-life demonstrators to pray peacefully and silently, even within the 36-foot zone, and then accept the legal penalty for doing so, to not resist when carried off to prison. The manifold regulations and intricate financial arrangements of the modern state present a myriad of opportunities to draw lines against injustice, each of which needs to be patiently considered. And yet, It hasn't moved people the same way the anti-segregation civil disobedience moved people. A crucial point, I think, is that even though the laws and ordinances like the no pro-life protest zone, the 36-foot zone, even though a law like that provides part of the support structure for abortion, in itself, the zone does not require committing an intrinsically evil act. If you honored the 36-foot zone, you wouldn't be doing something intrinsically evil. The 36-foot rule only undermined the common good by imposing disproportionate punishments and by burdening the pro-life view with official opprobrium and condemnation. And in such cases, civil disobedience is not an unconditional duty, but a matter of discretion, something to be weighed according to whether it would do more good or harm. Another complication is that in order to decide whether violating the law might cause scandal, you have to consider the situation. I don't think King thought about that. I think he thought it's not going to cause scandal if everybody knows what we're doing. Maybe there's more to it. In the 60s, there were a lot of journalists who were sympathetic to the civil rights movement. Not all, of course. But there were a lot, and they presented the demonstrations in a favorable light. Then they took footage of, police dogs biting peaceful demonstrators who were doing nothing but praying or kneeling on the ground with their hands over their heads or something. And this aroused the indignation of people and the pity of people. But today, though, most journalists are hostile to the pro-life movement in a way that they were not to the movement against segregation. And these journalists will do all they can to obscure the difference between praying in the driveway and planting a bomb in the waiting room. The difference in the attitude of journalists increases the risk that people of weak understanding will misunderstand what is going on. So that the good example that King expected may not happen, and the arousal of conscience that King expected may not happen. Perhaps this fact helps to explain why protests against abortion have been less successful in arousing conscience than protests against racial segregation. I don't know. These are only speculations. These are matters that Aquinas didn't consider. King advanced the understanding of these, but that he didn't consider either. Now, I've also been speaking, let's make it still more messy. I've been speaking as though all civil disobedience is by private individuals, but as we know, sometimes it isn't. Is it ever the case that lesser public officials may refuse to comply with unjust laws or policies that are made by higher public officials? Or that if you've got a government of separation of powers, where you've got three independent branches, one may disobey what is required by another. Thomas Aquinas didn't discuss that, but some Reformation era theories of civil disobedience, which arose after his time and it were somewhat influenced by his theory, did address that and thought that perhaps such a thing would be permissible. So what would that mean? Would it be permissible, for instance, for a sheriff to refuse to enforce an unjust law allowing persons of one view to demonstrate peacefully within his 36-foot zone, but not to allow persons of the other view to do so if he disobeyed that? Might that be right? Or might a judge refuse to impose sentence under a law which requires medical workers to assist at abortions? So there's a medical worker who says, I won't do it, and she violates a regulation at a public hospital or something. Might a judge refuse to impose sentence or refuse to rule sympathetically about in other ways? Or if pharmacists violated, suppose that the government in all 50 states made euthanasia legal and said that assisting in suicide is an obligation of all doctors and pharmacists too in releasing the drugs, dispensing the drugs. And let's say that a pharmacist refused to sell drugs to poison people and he was hauled up for violation of the law. Might a judge refuse to sentence him? Or might he declare him guilty but vacate the sentence? You're guilty according to the law, but it's an unjust law and I will give you no sentence. Or might a county registrar refuse to file the marriage license of a brother and sister, even though the government has legalized incest. Wait, you say, Budziszewski, you're being tricky. I know that case, and it wasn't about incest. Well, no, it wasn't, but it might as well have been. Yet another complication is that so far I've been speaking as though the problem were merely one just unjust law at a time. Sometimes it isn't. What if it isn't just that a basically decent government has dreadfully passed an unjust law, but what if the whole government itself becomes tyrannical if it is unjust through and through? We've had enough tyranny in history. Well, you won't be surprised that Thomas Aquinas talked about this too. And I'm following his analysis here too, rather than say the analysis of John Locke, which had a lot of influence on the American revolutionaries, or the analysis of Karl Marx, which had a lot of influence on the Russian revolutionaries. The best thing to do, of course, is to take care, Thomas Aquinas says, that the government doesn't become tyrannical in the first place. How do you do that? I mean, it sounds easy. Yeah. But you know, there's a difference between being careless and saying, well, I hope it doesn't become tyrannical, and actually doing something about it. Aquinas suggests that one thing that this requires is a good and balanced governmental structure. The idea of balance of powers is not just a contemporary or early modern idea. Balanced governmental structure, which recognizes the principle of rule by law. And the other thing that he says it requires, this is interesting, is virtue. You can't keep your government from falling into tyranny if neither the people nor the rulers have virtue. They have to have good moral character. You can't expect them to behave justly if they don't even understand the virtue of justice. And you can't expect them to have the virtue of justice if they don't have any of the other virtues, because all of the virtues depend on each other and mutually support each other. All right, but what if you've tried to take some of these precautions? You've got a decent governmental structure or something. Well, there is no mechanical guarantee that government will not fall into tyranny. It could happen anyway. What if the government does, despite all precautions, degenerate into tyranny? According to Aquinas, the answer depends in part on what kind of tyranny it is. That's a funny thought. There are kinds of tyranny? Well, yeah. He says, you know, in one sense, tyranny is the very worst kind of rule. It isn't even properly to be considered a government at all. It's more like the absence of government, because the ruler is attacking the common good deliberately. Let's call this extreme tyranny or energetic tyranny. Most tyranny, though, isn't like that, he says. Most everyday lazy tyranny. He doesn't say this, but I would dare to say that probably most government and most times and places during most of human history has been everyday lazy tyranny. Everyday lazy tyranny is not as bad, because the ruler isn't attacking the common good. He's merely neglecting it. He doesn't give a darn. Okay? If the tyranny, he may care for the common good to some degree just in order to protect his own position. You know, but only to that degree, only to the degree that he has to. And he's going to be sloppy in even those cases. If the tyranny is of the everyday sort, Aquinas thinks it's probably better to tolerate it than to resist it. Why? Isn't even everyday lazy tyranny a bad thing? Isn't it still tyranny? Isn't it unjust? Well, sure it is. But he says, this is a judgment call. This is a judgment of prudence on his part. He says the difficulty is that worse evils threaten no matter how the resistance turns out. How so? Well, suppose that you engage in, say, armed resistance against a lazy tyranny, and the resistance fails. You fail to overturn the tyrant. It may provoke him to rage, so that before he was merely a lazy tyrant, but now he becomes the energetic type. But if the resistance succeeds, might it not succeed? He says, well, what we learn from history, again, this isn't just a philosophical conclusion. This is a judgment based on his own study of history and his judgment of prudence. He says, it seems that even when such armed resistance succeeds, the most likely result of its success is you have a period of rule by competing revolutionary factions. And this state of affairs usually ends with one of the factions, the most ruthless of them, gaining the upper hand over the others, and the leader of that faction seizes the tyranny for himself, and he says, and you can bet your bottom dollar that he's going to be the extreme sort of tyrant. The new tyrant is likely to be much harsher than the one who was replaced, if for no other reason than that he fears to suffer the same fate as the old one. So once again, one has merely replaced a lazy tyranny with an extreme one. Does Thomas Aquinas say there are no exceptions? He does not say that. But does he say that this is what usually happens, and so just as a judgment of prudence, it wouldn't seem like a great idea to think, well, we've got just an everyday tyranny, let's knock it off. Okay. Well, what if we're not dealing with an everyday lazy tyranny? What if it is the extreme sort? Now, that's a dire situation. Now, in this case, Aquinas does propose resistance of a sort. Notice I didn't say armed resistance. I said resistance of a sort. But he insists that it be carried out constitutionally. Remember I said at the beginning of the talk, he's very concerned that even when we're resisting something unethical, we have to make sure that we do it by ethical means. That was something Martin Luther King said, too. The means that we employ must be as moral as the ends that we seek, said King. He gets that from Thomas Aquinas also. So that even when you are resisting unprincipled government, you should act in a principled way. Even when you are attacking violations of the constitutional order, you should try to proceed in a constitutional manner yourself. Now, so you're going to carry out your resistance constitutionally. You're going to do it by public authority rather than by private presumption, by vigilantes. The constitutional traditions of various countries might provide various ways to depose a tyrant. By way of example, Aquinas considers only one such case. This is the only one he mentions, and people think, well, doesn't he know that there are other kinds of governmental structures than this? No, he knows that, but he's giving an example. He says, in many countries, there was a king, and there was a senate, and there were the assemblies of the people. He's thinking about something like that. We have something like that. We have a president, we have a senate, we have a House of Representatives. House of Representatives isn't the same as an assembly of the people, but there's some resemblance. Okay, maybe the assemblies of the people in a particular country are the people who have the authority to appoint a king. And the assemblies of the people appointed the king, and he became a tyrant. Well, then, by implication, wouldn't it be the assemblies of the people who have the authority to remove him? Sure. Well, he says, they should use this authority. Throw him out of office. Now, he recognizes, and I'm sure you see it too, that this strategy proposes a problem, because the tyrant is probably going to try to keep them from doing that. He's probably going to resist any attempt to throw him out of office. For example, he might just forbid the assemblies of the people to meet. Well, again, Aquinas counsels constitutional resistance. He says if there are further constitutional means of resistance available, make use of them. For example, suppose your state belongs to what he called an empire, what we call a federation. And the central authority, what he called the emperor, it's possible to appeal to the emperor. And so your country, which is part of this federation, has fallen under tyranny. You can appeal to the emperor. All right? Well, if so, do it. That suggestion might sound very strange. Well, we don't have emperors anymore. We don't have kings anymore. Interestingly, by his definition of a king, he would consider our president a king. And interestingly, by his definition of an empire, he would consider the United States an empire because it's a federation of 50 states together into one unit. And you may be surprised to learn that our Constitution actually does include provision for appeal to the emperor. Have you ever heard of the Republican Guarantee Clause? Hardly anybody learns about this when they're in school and they study con law. The Republican Guarantee Clause is in the Constitution. It guarantees any state of the union to appeal to the United States as a whole for the restoration of Republican government. In other words, if any state has fallen into tyranny, it can appeal to the feds, help us out here. Okay? So Thomas Aquinas says, yeah, do that. Well, what if that fails too? What if you've gone through all the list of constitutional means of appeal possible? Then would it be permissible for private individuals to take matters into their own hands? Might they start a revolutionary army? Might they attempt tyrannicide? He doesn't just dismiss the idea, he takes it seriously. For instance, he concedes that there might even seem to be a biblical precedent in the slaying of the Moabite king Eglon by a fellow named Ehud. But in the end, he rejects tyrannicide, and he says, you know, that precedent isn't a precedent anyway. Among other things, the killing of Ehud was not actually a tyrannicide, because Eglon was not a king of Israel. He was a king of an enemy country that was had been at war with Israel and was an occupying force. So Ehud was not acting as a private individual. He was acting as a soldier under the authority of the nation of Israel in its unjust war against the invader. He has philosophical and prudential arguments against tyrannicide, too. He says it's going to be done by private presumption, and you just don't know what's going to happen then. Well, now that raises an interesting possibility, this business of it being a foreign king, that Aquinas doesn't discuss in his work, but that it would seem to be permitted by his analysis of still another subject, which is just war. Among the causes of war, he claims, among the just causes of war, the things for which it might be legitimate to go to war for, are securing peace, punishing evildoers, some country is invading another country, killing everybody, and uplifting the good. Suppose then that for just such reasons as these, your country's fallen under a tyranny, and other nations see what's going on, the war against the common good that your tyrant is doing, and they declare a just war against your country. It would seem that a member of the tyrannized country might act under their commission against their tyrant, because he's not a legitimate ruler, and they're not acting by private presumption anymore. They're acting under somebody's legitimate authority, and legitimate authority doesn't exist in their own country anymore, so they do it under the authority of another. Assuming that all the other conditions of just war are fulfilled, then that act would be permissible for the same reason that Ehud's was. It would not be an act of private presumption, but a public authority. He gives two other reasons for rejecting vigilantism. One of them is theological. One of them is philosophical. He says, the theological reason is this. He says, it contradicts apostolic teaching. The philosophical reason is, it's imprudent. Why is it imprudent? Because the assassination of undesired rulers, if you did say it was okay to assassinate undesired rulers by private presumption, this privilege would more often be used by wicked men to slay good kings than by good men to slay tyrants. And given the state of the world, that seems realistic. This warning would seem to concern, though, not just solitary rebels, but rebel armies. Suppose the rebels claimed to represent the people as a whole. You know, there was an awful lot of shifty stuff going on in the American Revolution about that. It may or may not be true that they had the consent of the majority of the people. But, you know, Thomas Paine, you remember Tom Paine, the firebrand of the American Revolution, wrote the revolutionary pamphlet, Common Sense. A couple of decades after the war, in a work that he wrote called Disquisition on the First Principles of Government, old Tom Paine said, yes, of course, the revolutionaries should act only with the consent of the people. Consent is such a fundamental principle of government. The revolutionaries should only act with the consent of the people. But he says, time makes more converts than reason. So maybe they're going to have to act on the presumption of future consent. They make a revolution, nobody consents, but they figure after we've overturned the government and set up, everything will be so wonderful that then everybody will consent, and they will say what you did back then was great. Okay, that's pretty shabby. Aquinas does hold that a morally competent people should be ruled with their consent. They should only lose, for instance, the privilege to elect their own leaders if they become so corrupt that they sell their votes. He doesn't discuss the possibility that rebels might claim to represent the people when they don't, but the tenor of his argument suggests that a claim like that would not impress him. Many competing groups may claim to represent the people as a whole. That doesn't mean they do, and he's already explained that factional conflict tends to produce tyrannies even better than those that it sweeps away. Let's kick up the argument still one more notch. I'm in the home stretch here, okay? There's a lot of distinctions, all right? But I'm in the home stretch. Suppose that both national and extranational public authority fails to remove a tyrant. Then, even barring vigilante actions that would make matters still worse. Is there anything else you can do? You might snicker at this one. He says, yeah, there is one more thing. But it's something you should have been doing from the beginning. You can pray. Pray? We think, how ridiculous. But Aquinas thinks that prayer, under such circumstances, is the most practical thing you can do. Why? Because tyranny is very unlikely to arise among a virtuous people. It's very unlikely to arise among a population that has a real sense of the common good and a dedication to it. And if it does arise, then probably it does arise because they have been softened and prepared for the tyranny by a long period of moral decay. Until things get very bad indeed, they might even like to be ruled by a tyrant, either because the regime has given certain constituencies private benefits, or because most citizens have not yet been personally hurt, or because the desires of the people are so disordered that they can't even clearly conceive what the common good is. They can't clearly recognize their own depraved condition. In Aquinas' view, God does not very often protect corrupt nations from the natural consequences of their own corruption. He more often allows these consequences to develop in order to bring corrupt nations to their senses. And if you do come to your senses, then maybe the best medicine for the corruption of your virtues is to humbly repent and ask God for the grace to do better. So at last, if at last the people do repent and mend their ways, then the hope is that God will hear their prayers. But Aquinas warns, I quote, "To deserve this benefit from God, the people must desist from sin, for it is by divine permission that wicked men receive power to rule as a punishment for sin." Let me end this talk with something that may surprise you. You may think that although this idea of a need to couple constitutional resistance to tyranny with repentance and prayer and moral reform, that might have been a staple of long ago medieval thinking about statecraft, but nobody thinks like that now. You know, nobody, the American revolutionaries didn't think like that. They just said, to arms, to arms. Interestingly and surprisingly, and this doesn't get into the history textbooks, but to anybody who studies the writing of that age, it's unmistakable. They did think about that. I don't say that the American Revolution fulfilled Aquinas' criteria for resistance. It probably didn't. But as to the importance of prayer and moral reform as for the success of the cause, the American patriots actually agreed. The importance of coupling the quest for independence with prayer and moral reform were major themes of colonial preaching, which, by the way, was one of the major venues of political discourse. And of discussion, political discussion. We tend to forget that the War of Independence was not just a military and political enterprise, it was a moral crusade. They said, England is morally corrupt. We have been too corrupt. We can pray to God for help, and they thought we can take up arms, but we don't have a snowball's chance on a hot summer day of succeeding unless we clean up our act first. Thank you for your attention. And I'd be glad to respond to your questions.
Yes.
I'm not sure if I missed something, but what exactly, in cases where the legitimate political authority is a subject of dispute, I think, for example, there was a period of time during the French Revolution where both the king and the National Assembly declared themselves to be the legitimate government of France.
Yes, that's hard.
What exactly is the response?
You didn't miss anything. He hasn't given an answer to that. And I don't have an answer to it either. There was also a period in the history of the church when there were several rival claimants to the papacy. You know, I don't know a theological solution to that. And he doesn't address it. Mostly, he doesn't discuss details of constitutional arrangements and solutions to constitutional problems. What he's trying to give is some rough and ready prudential judgments and also some philosophical principles to guide your approach to such problems. So, I mean, that's why you didn't hear it. He doesn't address it. Okay? Who else? Yes, sir.
Thank you for your talk. Very good. Immigration.
Yes.
So I had a discussion with a fellow cleric one time, and let's just say he said something that I'm not going to repeat.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, you can't say that. He said, what's an unjust law? So a couple of things come to mind in my question. One is applying it to immigration.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
But number two is, like, isn't it kind of presumptuous to us to be able to say that it's unjust? Like, where is my authority to say it's unjust?
Okay.
So, like, you know, I mean, how do I know enough and so forth and
Very
so
good.
On?
All right. Well, there are two problems here. Two questions, really.
Yeah.
One is the problem of presumption. Who am I to say this law is unjust? Well, it would be nice to say the path of humility is never make a judgment that the law is unjust, but sometimes we have to. It isn't, and sometimes it isn't hard. You know, I gave some easy examples earlier. If they're telling you, help us send Jews to the death camps, you have to say no. If they're telling you, and this was a regulation under the Obama administration too, they wanted to deprive healthcare workers of their freedom of conscience protection so they could be coerced into participating in abortions and things. Well, you can't do it. You can't do it. You have to say no. You have to say no. There are many cases, though, where it's not obvious that the law is unjust, and where the decision that the law is unjust may be based not on fundamental principle, but on judgments of prudence. And I think in a case like that, you should probably defer to your elected representatives. Now, the other question is concerning immigration. I don't think that it is impossible to say that a particular immigration law could be unjust. And in such a case, perhaps could be properly disobeyed. Unfortunately, I think that a lot of the discussion of this has been marred by unjust assumptions. People proceed as though the very idea of having restrictions on immigration were unjust, as though a country has no right to regulate its borders for the common good, for the sake of its own protection. That seems to be absurd. So, unfortunately, we have people talking past each other on this issue because there are some mistakes in principle being made on both sides.
Yeah, because I think the issue is a border part of the natural law. Like,
well, the border.
People argue. It just gets frustrating. I mean, I work with a lot of immigrants in my community.
Yeah. Yeah.
And people don't realize that when you break one law, like to enter the country, it's not just one law you break. You're constantly breaking the law just to function in the country. So,
yes,
for example,
that's
when I first got to the town where I work, where I live, I noticed a lot of out-of-state license plates.
Uh-huh.
And I'm thinking, wow, this is a pretty diverse community here. So I realized, oh, they're not allowed to get licenses, so they're going to other states to get insurance.
Oh, I see.
And so you have a lot of people that are not taking driving tests, but drive. So it's not just one thing that happens. It's a cascade of things because you're in such a situation that you're being... There's a reason why they don't allow you to have others. You know?
Yes, I agree with you. The point that you make... Or rather, you didn't make it because you weren't making a point. You were commenting that people sometimes say, "Well, is a border a matter of natural law?"
It's becoming very popular.
And I had not ever actually heard it put that way. But that's an interesting question: is a border a matter of natural law? In one sense, no. And in one sense, yes. There are. Thomas Aquinas says there are two different ways in which human ordinances, human laws, can be derived from the natural law. Sometimes it's a simple matter of deduction. Murder is wrong. By the natural law, the human law ought to punish murder. All right, that's a no-brainer. Sometimes, on the other hand, you can't come up with what the regulation should be just by logical deduction, which he calls conclusion from premises. You come up with it by what he calls determination or specification. I like to call it filling in the blanks.
or pinning the generality down. It might be, the natural law tells you that you should have regard for the safety of your neighbors. Prudence tells you that in order to have regard for the safety of your neighbors, you're going to have to regulate traffic on the public highways. There is no logical way to say they ought to drive on the right. They ought to drive on the left. Either way would do. So you just pick one. You know, there's no natural law that says the border has to be right here. Those things are negotiated. They depend on so many different kinds of things that are not purely matters of the natural law. But on the other hand, that a community of people should be able to protect themselves as a community, and that declared and known borders are probably necessary to that, makes sense. It's not a logical deduction from the natural law, but it is a, what he calls a determinatio, a determination, a specification, like driving on the right. Maybe in some world you could imagine a different way to protect communities of people without borders. Fine. We haven't found one yet, but that would be nice. Yes, sir.
So a lot of your examples are kind of like in a perfect society where everyone's on board with approaching, or the group of people that's resisting is like perfectly in sync in their thoughts. But we, in our society now, there's a lot of, I guess, diverse factions who maybe have a similar end in mind, but for ulterior motives or different reasons, and compromise is a common topic.
Mm-hmm.
How do we like best kind of discern that path, especially like resistance to tyranny?
Okay, I think it's a good question. I disagree with one of your premises. You said many, my examples seem to assume everybody's on the same, what's the expression?
Language.
Yeah. and actually, you remember Thomas Aquinas calls attention to the fact that there may be different groups that are fighting with each other and struggling, different revolutionary factions. He says, this is one of the problems. Now, you're right, though, that when people disagree, sometimes they have to negotiate and compromise. Any compromise that requires you to approve what is intrinsically evil would be wrong. But most compromises are not like that. Most of them are things where, one group thinks it would be better to do this, there'd be less harm to the common good to do this, the other says, no, that would make it worse. Consider, for instance, debates over, this isn't such a gross, well, some people think of it as a gross matter of justice or injustice, but debates over the reform of the marijuana law, should marijuana be legal or not? One group says, no, that's going to be awful. And, well, they can talk with each other here, right? They can talk with each other. They can negotiate. I hope the negotiation isn't going to be just a point of figuring what's my political advantage. What can I force him to agree to? But I hope that there's going to be some discussion here. And unfortunately, most public discussion is at a very, very low level. People will say, for instance, well, alcohol is legal. Why shouldn't marijuana be? Well, maybe marijuana should be. But, marijuana is not like alcohol. Okay, it affects you in different ways than alcohol does. With alcohol, we also, this may seem unjust if you like marijuana, but we've had centuries of experience with it, and certain social norms have developed in order to control some consequences of unregulated behavior. And that hasn't been the case with marijuana. There might be genetic damage in the case of marijuana. That's disputed, but apparently there isn't with alcohol. With alcohol, the more you drink, the drunker you get. But on the other hand, some people claim that if they've had experience with drinking alcohol, they are able to have a few drinks and not be so tipsy. I don't know, some of that is rationalization, maybe true, but I've at least heard, I'm not a marijuana user, so I don't know, but I've at least heard it argued, and I've seen it discussed on the websites of marijuana users. Some claim that the more experience you have using it, the quicker you become intoxicated, just the opposite of being able to, quote unquote, hold your liquor, right? These are all such differences, and nobody ever thinks of them. There's also the problem of public confusion. If we say, well, this is going to be legal, and this intoxicating substance will be legal, and this one isn't, and this one is, and this one isn't, and this one is, people are going to be awful confused, and they're going to say, well, let's legalize heroin too. Let's legalize cocaine. Let's legalize everything. How do you, in order to work through these practical problems, the level of public discussion is going to have to be much more discriminating and intelligent than it is. Instead of just people saying, legalize, no, don't legalize, they're going to have to think. instead of just hurl slogans against, at each other. And that's true in some disagreements about what justice requires, too. Yes, sir.
We'll be next, man.
How should we think correctly about a law that says that families can only have one child, seeing as how it incentivizes going against the natural law? It takes away authority from parents. Mm-hmm. And it's not quite temporal only.
Yes, yes, I agree. I think it incentivizes abortion, obviously. It's had that consequence. It's I think it's directly against the natural law because of its invasion of the responsibility of parents for their families. It's amazing the terrible consequences it's had in China. If most Chinese parents, if they could only have one child, well, they prefer a male child. And so it's usually the female children that are getting aborted here, and the sex differential is way off. You can even get into the economic questions here, which are not matters of basic principle, but judgments of prudence. I'm no expert on economics. But a lot of economists say what you need is a growing population in order to keep your economy going. And the future problem of the world doesn't seem to be overpopulation, but underpopulation. I think that has been a disaster for China. Rather than scrapping the one-child policy, unfortunately, they only moderated it to the two-child policy. Okay, we won't make you take two poison pills, only one. Right? I'm unhappy about that. But it must mean that even the elites there are beginning to recognize the even if not the moral problems with what they're doing, at least they're recognizing the demographic problems. You know that the rate of abortion is several hundred million abortions in China. And even by the government's own statistics, several millions of those were where they broke in the door and held down the woman and committed an abortion there. And yes, dear Lord. Yeah, thank you. Yes, ma'am. Okay, I understand the situation that you're describing, and I'm not sure that I understand the question.
If we have an issue like gun control, which is obviously a very hot button topic in this country,
right?
And you have the conservative right who says that this is our right to bear arms, and this is morally justified, government being monopoly.
Yeah.
And the left saying that this is clearly very dangerous.
Yes. Okay. Well, there's no sort of instant. There's no sort of instant solution from principle in a case like that. For instance, I don't think that according to the natural law there is necessarily a right to bear arms, but there is a right to defend yourself, and it might be argued potentially that requires a right to bear arms, all right, possibly. But you notice that you've got more than principle going here. You've got some judgments of prudence too. Here's another example of a judgment of prudence that tends to get overlooked in public discussion. I would personally agree with those who say that certain types of weapons aren't even conceivably necessary for ordinary defense of your home and so forth, and are just good for committing mayhem. But many people go further than that. They assume that any weapon at all means an increase in violence. And there are some studies which suggest statistically that gun violence is lower in societies where you have concealed weapons laws, like my home state of Texas, that because the bad guys are afraid to pull a gun because somebody's going to shoot them. I have to tell you a funny story. I went to I visited once to teach a course on Christian political thought through the ages in a town in Canada. Next to a university there, the Canadians tend to be much more anti-gun than Americans, and certainly much more anti-gun than Texans. And I made a mistake in thinking that something would be taken as a joke. The provost of the school at which I was teaching this course was chatting me up at the visiting faculty reception and said, we just don't understand here why you Americans have this fixation on guns. And just pulling her leg a little bit, I thought, I said, well, there are some practical advantages to this. For instance, I've been teaching your students here, and they're very nice students, and on the whole, very well-mannered, but every now and then they get rowdy, and so I just pull out my iron, and they quiet right down, and she just about had a heart attack, because she got mad at it. There are questions of prudence here, and unfortunately, neither side tends to be very willing to actually consider the arguments of the other and consider the evidence for the various claims, for the various prudential conclusions that are being proposed. And neither side tends to be very patient with the distinction between, on the one hand, considerations of principle, you do have a right to defend yourself, and on the other hand, considerations of prudence, what do you actually need to defend yourself, and what makes things more dangerous and what makes things less. So, I mean, that's a messy answer, right? Except for the joke. That's a messy answer because I can't just say natural law requires this gun control policy or this opposition gun control policy. But the natural law doesn't actually claim that most of the answers can be deduced like theorems in geometry from the natural law. It says that in a lot of cases you do need to exercise prudence. And unfortunately that not everybody is really prudent. And we all have to try to be more. Yes, ma'am.
Two-part question.
Okay.
Aquinas assumes a particular understanding of nature.
A particular what?
Understanding of nature.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. Natural law and a virtue ethics that builds from that understanding of nature. So it's kind of two questions. Could you consider a government that is not only responsible for the formation of laws, but seems also, like here in the U.S., to be sort of the agent of the redefining of what it means to have a nature in the first place, or a particular form to that?
I think that some in the government are trying to do that. When we, for instance, redefine marriage has always been understood as, why do you have marriage? People say, well, it's because of love. And if you don't, for instance, think that two people of the same sex can be married, that you're against love. It's not about love, actually. In the law, it's not about love. In the natural law, it is partly about love, but it's about the love between appropriate partners. The reason that the law is interested in marriage and why the law is not interested in my loving relationship with my lifelong friend or my relationship with my fishing buddy is that the family is uniquely the institution, the form of association that produces children and that brings them up. That procreation doesn't just mean reproducing, it means raising them, educating them, bringing them up so that they can be virtuous human beings themselves. And a kid needs a mom and a dad. That's the only reason that the civic law is interested in marriage. It has no interest in love per se. And I think that our current Supreme Court just doesn't understand that at all. And if you try to talk about these things, some people try to present reasoned, calm discussion about these kinds of things in arguments before the court. And they just say, that's irrational animus. It's like in George Orwell's 1984. Entire categories of argument you would dismiss by saying, what did they say? What was the word that they used? Crime thing. You know, this is crime thing. There are a lot of things that are, it's not so much. You ask whether there's an attempt to sort of redefine nature. Sometimes it seems that some people are doing that, but sometimes it seems that people are trying to deny that we have natures, to say that anybody can be really anything. I don't even have to be human. It's not just about the of sex that people get confused like this. There are people who have surgical modifications so that they look like cats. You know, their faces are full of hair and they have whiskers and claws and caps on their teeth that look like fangs and things like this. There are people who demand the right to have plastic surgery so that healthy limbs, so that they can compel their doctors to have surgery on them to remove a healthy limb because they say, I identify as a paraplegic person. You know, this isn't about the reconceiving of human nature. This is about the denial that the category nature even has any content, that there is an answer to the question, what is it to be a human being? And that I think is the more fundamental problem.
So to sort of ask maybe a follow-up question, does the moral obligation of somebody who does understand what it means to possess a human nature increase in proportion to...
Yes.
Yes,
the moral obligation increases because you have to bear public witness, or at least you have to bear private witness. You talk to your friends, which is a public responsibility. It's a civic action to talk to your friends, to try to talk sense, to try to learn sense, and then to try to talk sense, and to do everything that you can to it. To contribute to the spread of a little bit of common sense. You know, even today, most people, when pressed, won't accept all these kooky theories, right? What they may speak as though they do when they're talking to a pollster, or when they're being interviewed on TV, or when they're doing this or when they're doing that. But actually, they don't. You know, you talk to somebody and say, you know, you might say to the guy at the bus stop, you know, isn't it a funny thing? There are two kinds of this. I'm really glad that there isn't as men in the world. That would be pretty dull. Women are different, and, you know, guys like me need that. We have to be balanced, or we can really rather crazy. And people say, yeah, my wife, you know, she really keeps me sane. People understand. Well, natural lawyers call that complementarity. But you don't have to use high-octane words. This is a matter of common sense, and even today, most people have it. What happens is that they go to universities, and they learn theories. A large part of what is sometimes called theorizing about these things is disconnecting the wires of your common sense. Instead of taking your common sense and saying, it's a mess, let's elevate it, clarify it, clean it up, make it more noble, instead they say, let's disconnect that mess and not do anything. Classical philosophy, and this included Thomas Aquinas, thought that people do know something, but they don't always know what they know. They don't always know it clearly, and there's a lot of mess. And you try to elevate common sense and purify common sense. You don't just try to cut it off. Yes, sir? Okay. So, I'm told that you're the last question.
Okay. So a recent court determined that the parents of a self-declared transgender 17-year-old were unfit to care for the child and has since moved the child to the custody of their grandparents. The parents maintained that because the teenager was still a minor, they had the authority to reject the child's pleas to undergo hormone therapy, at least until the teenager turned 18. However, the court ruled that because they believed the gender dysphoria that the child was experiencing was placing the child at risk of committing suicide, the parents' decision to impede the child's hormone therapy was wrong. If I were a parent that cared deeply for my child and deeply believed that rejecting hormone therapy was for the good of my child, do I have the moral obligation to resist the court's ruling?
If you believed what? If you thought your child was transgender and needed hormone therapy?
No. If
you wanted to resist
exactly.
The imposition of this, yeah, you should resist the imposition of this. This is a truly bizarre ideology. It's a violation of parental authority. It's a violation of the nature of human beings. And you know the statistical research. It's really overwhelming on this kind of thing. You know, people who have this kind of surgery, they call it therapy. It's not therapy. When they have themselves biologically mutilated, they get all these hormone injections and so forth. You know, the idea was, well, I'm a man in a woman's body or something. If only I have a woman's body, then I'll feel better. What they find out is that they're just as depressed after the surgery and after readjustment as they were before. They're just as likely to have suicidal tendencies. They have just as many mental problems. It didn't help them. It only helps some people who have an ideology that requires them to believe that it somehow does help people. You know, to say that.
Well, I was about to say to quote one of these people, but it was actually unmentionable in a public forum. So yeah, I think that you have to resist that as a parent, and say I'm going to let my child live a normal human life, even if some elements of the government are controlled by an ideology that want to try to destroy that. This is hard. I mean, there have been tyrannies in history before, but there's never been a time when people had such when governments had a lot of people in them who were driven by such crazy ideologies. A lot of elements of the sociology of it have flipped too. It used to be, for instance, that lawyers and judges and so forth tend to be conservative elements of society, and they talked about the natural law, and they didn't want to change things too quickly. And now it's reversed. It's almost like they're revolutionaries. Well, thank you.